Our Constitution is a document in which we, the people, tell the government what it is allowed to do. We, the people, are free.
Well, once again, we welcome you back to the Constitution Classroom. Your host is Colonel John Eidsmo from the Foundation for Moral Law. Colonel, we finished unpacking the Sixth Amendment last time. It looks like we are ready to move on to the Seventh.
Absolutely. And that was a lengthy discussion of the Sixth Amendment, but there was so much in there. The rights to trial by an impartial public jury in the jurisdiction where the crime takes place. The rights to confront the witnesses who are testifying against you, the rights to testify or not testify as you see fit, the right to subpoena witnesses on your behalf, and the right to an attorney. But now we get to the Seventh Amendment, and the Seventh Amendment is also dealing with trials and dealing with jury. And we wonder, why do we have jury rights in both the Sixth and the Seventh Amendments? The answer is, in the Sixth Amendment, it is dealing with the rights to a jury in criminal cases. In the Seventh Amendment, it is dealing with the rights to a jury in civil cases. Criminal cases are when you have been charged with a crime. The state has come in, the police have come in, and maybe it's the city, the county, possibly it's the federal government, but they have charged you with a crime for which, if you are found guilty, you could be fined or jailed, or if it's something like murder, possibly even executed. In civil offenses, the government might bring a civil action, but normally this is brought by another person. And here we're talking about paying damages to that person for whatever damages you've caused by your action. Let's say, for example, let's say you run through a red light and hit somebody and cause an injury. Now, two things could happen as a result of that. One is the police might decide to charge you with a traffic offense, the criminal offense of running through a red light. Maybe you were drunk at the time, which will lead to an even greater charge. That could even lead to some jail time. But there, the government would have to prove you guilty by proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And if they do so, then you could be fined, or like in the DUI, you could be jailed. Now, the other thing that could happen out of that same case could be that the person you hit and injured might bring a civil lawsuit against you for the damages, the medical expenses, the pain and suffering. If he has permanent disability, the pain and suffering from that, loss of income from it, and so on. And damage to his vehicle as well. That won't get out as a criminal conviction on your record, but it could get pretty expensive, particularly if you don't have insurance. Anyway, that's the difference between civil law and criminal law. The Sixth Amendment protects your rights to trial by jury in a case involving criminal law. The Seventh Amendment, your right to trial by jury in a case involving civil law. In other words, we get to the Seventh Amendment, you're not being threatened with a criminal conviction. You're not being threatened with being executed or being jailed, but you could have to pay some monetary damage. Anyway, so the right to trial by jury is guaranteed here in civil cases by the Seventh Amendment in suits at common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20. The right of trial by jury shall be preserved. This hasn't involved a whole lot of attention today because most people think this is pretty cut and dry and pretty routine, but it has involved some. And the interesting thing is, this is one of the main objections that the anti-federalists had to the Constitution, that the Constitution did not contain a right to trial by jury in civil cases. And again, as we saw before, with these various objections based on the lack of the Bill of Rights, James Madison and other supporters of the Constitution promised that as soon as the Constitution was ratified, they'd immediately go to work on a Bill of Rights. And with that promise, the Constitution was ratified, and yes, they kept their word and they went to work on a Bill of Rights. It is interesting that this had been a matter of abuse with the American colonies, and one of the concerns that they had raised earlier with England was that their right to trial by jury in civil cases was being abridged. This is also one of the grievances that is raised in the Declaration of Independence, one of the reasons why England, in the colonist view, had become tyrannical and no longer entitled to rule, and therefore we were entitled to our independence. Another interesting thing about the Seventh Amendment is that it was passed in Congress without debate, and apparently there was just no disagreement from anybody in Congress that this ought to be there, and it was worded correctly the first time, and so it passed without debate and went to the states and was ratified. But another interesting thing about it is you see the limitation here. In suits at common law, this excludes admiralty and maritime law, all the high seas and seas and things like this. But in suits of common law, and where the value in controversy shall exceed $20. Now, you might think that they would have put in a cost of living index there, and $20, of course, meant a lot more back in 1789 than it does today, at least 10 times as much, probably more. But at any rate, $20, though, remains $20. $20 is worth a lot less today, but even today, if you are suing for $21, or if you are being sued for $21, you are entitled to a trial by jury on that case. Another point I make here is, yes, you are entitled to a trial by jury, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you are going to have one. Sometimes courts might choose instead that, whether defendants or plaintiffs might choose instead that, we would just as soon have this case tried by a judge alone rather than by a jury. Several reasons for this. For one thing, if you have your trial by a judge alone, normally you'll be able to go to court a lot more quickly than you have to wait for the next jury term. Secondly, if it's a trial by a judge alone, you're not going to involve all the time that is spent on jury selection and all the time that is spent on making the jury file out while you make a motion to the judge, and all the time you spend there giving instructions to the jury and then waiting for the jury to deliberate. In other words, the trial can take place a lot faster if it's before a judge alone, and being a lot faster, that means your attorney, who is probably billing you by the hour, is going to charge you less. You might also think that this is a case where a judge would probably understand the case better, or maybe where you might think that a judge might be more sympathetic to you than a jury would. And that might be just based on the fact that maybe you think you're in the right on this case, but that there's a lot of emotional factors that might weigh against you that a jury would consider and a judge might not. I have to add to that quickly that when I got out of law school, I had the idea that judges were almost miniature gods, and that every case they decided was purely on the law of the facts and no emotion entered in. But I have learned over the years that that simply is not true, that judges are influenced by emotion as well. But at any rate, you might know something about this particular judge. You might know that this judge tends to award low verdicts or low money judgments or high money judgments, and based on the judge that you have this time, you might think, well, I really don't want this judge making the final decision. I'd rather have this case tried by a jury. And anyway, so there might be some reasons why either side would decide, I'd rather go for a judge. However, if either side wants a jury, there's going to be a jury. In other words, both sides have to agree that the judge alone, or else the jury is not going to be involved in this case. So we see that this is an important right. We'll see certain ways this right is limited as we move to our break and after the break. But One way that we limit this is by small claims court. And I'll talk a little bit about small claims court after we have our break.
Okay. And again, for those who would like to follow up on this, of course, you can subscribe to the podcast at lovingliberty.net. You can also subscribe at the Loving Liberty Show, or the Loving Liberty Network, rather, at Anchor. And you can also visit the website for the Foundation for Moral Law, which is simply morallaw.org. This is Constitution Classroom. Your host is Colonel John Eidsmo. We will be back to continue our discussion of the Seventh Amendment just the other side of these commercial messages. To Constitution Classroom. Your host is Colonel John Eidsmo from the Foundation for Moral Law. And Colonel, you are currently helping us understand the Seventh Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Let's pick up where you left off.
Again, the Seventh Amendment is dealing with the right to trial by jury in civil cases. Criminal cases are covered by the Sixth. Civil cases are covered by the Seventh. And I mentioned just as we were going to break that a new development that is taking place in the courts, when I say new, I mean within like the last 40, 50 years or so, but it's really a resurrection of things that we used to have early in the legal system, is what we call small claims court. Now, small claims court is a court that will have jurisdiction over cases that are not that serious in terms of the amount of money involved. And the reason for small claims court is so that people can go before these courts and save a lot of the cost. Chief Justice Warren Burger was one of the pioneers of this movement, and Burger came to be on the Supreme Court during the Nixon administration, 1969 to about 73-74, and he was a moderate to conservative Chief Justice, considerably more conservative than his predecessor, Earl Warren, and probably less conservative than his successor, William Rehnquist. But Burger did a lot of things for the court that a lot of people don't realize. And one of these was streamlining the system. Burger made the statement at one time that America has developed the best system of justice the world has ever seen, but we have priced it beyond the reach of the average person. Yes, you are probably more likely to ultimately find justice in an American court, he said, than just about any other court anywhere in the world. But when you consider all the costs of getting an attorney and paying the jurors' fees and all this sort of thing, we have made it so expensive to try to find justice that it is nearly impossible, and it just isn't really worth it. And so one of the things he pioneered was this movement for small claims court, where if the parties are willing, they can have their case tried not in a regular court by trial by jury or judge in a regular court, but rather they can opt to go to this small claims court, where it'll be more informal, where commonly you will not have an attorney and probably won't need one. In most states, if you want to bring an attorney with you in the small claims court, you can, but that's not required and it is not the norm. But small claims court would hear these smaller cases and give a verdict much more quickly. And the way of getting things resolved with not having all the expense that you have with a lawyer. The one thing about small claims court, and why I'm mentioning it here, is simply that normally, and this, there might be some states where they do this differently, but I'm not aware of any, but normally in small claims courts, you would not have a jury. But again, that's because you have chosen to go that route instead of to go to the trial by jury that you'd have in a regular court. Now, there's another portion of the Seventh Amendment. We've already seen the part that says in all suits of common law where the controversy is over less than $20, and as we saw, $20 is still the figure today that has not been adjusted for inflation and couldn't be without a constitutional amendment. But the next part is what we call the re-examination clause. And this part of the Seventh Amendment says, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. What is the benefit of having a jury, you might ask? If I don't like the jury verdict, then all I have to do then is just appeal to a higher court, and there a judge is going to reverse the jury. So what's really the point of having the right to trial by jury? Well, this clause is in there for a very important reason. It's to protect this right to trial by jury from being abused by being reversed at a higher level. What's the point of having that right if a appellate court can just simply reverse what the jury does? Anyway, it says that it cannot be re-examined by any other court, meaning an appellate court. In Alabama, we have here the circuit courts that hear trial cases and so on. They can be appealed to the Court of Civil Appeals or the Court of Criminal Appeals. Those cases can be appealed up to the Alabama State Supreme Court. Federal level, we have the Federal District Court, and decisions there can be appealed to the circuit courts of appeals, the various circuits throughout the country, and from there to the U.S. Supreme Court. But this is protection of the right to trial by jury, saying that if a jury has made a decision, that decision by the jury cannot be reversed, with some exceptions that we're going to see in just a minute. Now, let me just mention a couple things here about jury verdicts on this, and that's that today, in contrast to in the 1700s, the authority of the jury in hearing cases has been greatly limited. It used to be that juries would decide matters of law as well as matters of fact, whereas today, juries will normally only decide questions of fact, and questions of law will be left to the judge. I'm trying to think of a good example, and I'm going to try to give you one out of real life. I have a rather unusual life, I guess you might say, but to explain here what the difference between a question of fact that a jury would decide versus a question of law that a judge would decide, we live out in the country, and the next-door neighbors of the farm next to us, well, they don't have them anymore, but for some years, they had camels in their back, in their pasture. And anyway, those camels, they're a little bigger than horses, but those camels and my horses became friends. First, my horses were a little wary of these strange animals that were awfully big and didn't look like a horse is supposed to look, as they thought, but they got over that, and they would enjoy just spending time just standing next to each other and touching noses across the fence and so on. But let's suppose that one of my neighbor's camels were to break through the fence and come onto my property. And let's suppose that in my anger at what my neighbor had done, I shot his camel. I wouldn't do that, of course, but let's just suppose that I had. Now we have two questions. Question is, let's say my neighbor is suing me for shooting his camel. Let's say the first question is a question of law. Did I have a right to shoot his camel for trespassing on my property? That's a question of law that only a judge would decide. The second question is, did I in fact shoot the camel? And did in fact that camel break through my fence and cross over to my property? In other words, maybe that camel didn't cross the fence at all. Maybe that fence had been down. That was my negligence. And maybe I'd left the gate open or something like that. But the jury, or the judge, first of all, would decide whether at law I had the right to shoot the camel. The jury then would decide whether, in fact, I had shot the camel. That was the way it was traditionally. And anyway, we're going to see in a little bit that the re-examination clause affects whether an appellate court could review the decision that a jury had made in regard to whether I had shot that camel.
Like that, we are back with Colonel John Eidsmo from the Foundation for Moral Law. This is Constitution Classroom. And Colonel, you were just finishing up with an example of the difference between the judge telling, you know, the judging the law and the jury judging the facts. And did we want to continue with the camel analogy?
Again, the example would be if the judge would make a decision whether or not I had a legal right to shoot the camel, if the camel broke through the fence and came onto my property, then the jury would decide whether I had in fact shot that camel and whether the camel had in fact broken through the fence. Those would be questions of fact for the jury. The other question is a question of law for the judge. Now, the reason I mention this is that 200 years ago, juries commonly would consider questions of law as well as questions of fact. But we have come to restrict the power of juries, partly because lawyers have become so much more powerful than they used to be, but also because the laws themselves have become a lot more complex than they used to be. But let's say that the judge determines that, yes, I did have a right to shoot the camel if he came across my fence, and the jury concludes that the camel did come across the fence, and that, therefore, I was entitled to a verdict in my behalf for the shooting. Well, let's say that the other side, the owner of the camel, decides to appeal this to a higher court. The way we are reading the next part here of the Seventh Amendment, where it says, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. Now, the way that would normally be understood would be the appellate court, if my neighbor were to appeal that decision, the appellate court could review and decide whether or not the judge had been correct in ruling that I had the right to shoot a camel that came across my fence into my property. But that appellate court would not be entitled to re-examine the jury's decision that, in fact, the camel had done that. Anyway, so point is, judges or appellate judges can re-examine on appeal decisions of trial judges as to matters of law. But normally, they may not re-examine jury's decisions as to matters of fact. It says there that according to the rules of the common law, and the way this has commonly been applied now is to say that, yes, judges on the appellate level can review juries' determinations of fact, but with limit. The limit is this, that the judge at the appellate level, the appellate judge, would look at this and he would have to rule it on this basis. Not do I agree with the way the jury decided that case, but rather, was that jury's decision so outlandish that no reasonable jury could possibly have ruled in that way? In other words, was the jury's finding a fact here not just erroneous, but so clearly erroneous as to be at a breach of discretion and unreasonable? Only if it reaches that level of unreasonability does the appellate court have the right to review a jury's decision of fact? That's a pretty high burden to meet, but they do meet it sometimes, and creates a very strong presumption at the appellate level that the jury's factual decision was correct. Well, with that, let us move on to the Eighth Amendment. And the Eighth Amendment has several provisions that we need to look at. First of all, the entire Eighth Amendment says excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishment inflicted. Three separate clauses there, the excessive bail clause, the excessive fines clause, and the cruel and unusual punishment clause. So let's look at each of these in turn. First of all, excessive bail. Now, we need to recognize, first of all, that bail is not given as punishment. Bail is to make sure that the defendant will make all his court appearances, either that or in some cases, to make sure that the defendant does not pose a risk to the public while the trial is pending. You know, we arrest a defendant for a charge, we take the defendant down to the jail, we set the arraignment for a certain date and other motions for a certain date. The trial maybe is set, let's say, 8 months from now. But in the meantime, should the defendant be in jail? We have to remember that the defendant all this time is presumed innocent. The defendant is presumed innocent until proven guilty. And because he's presumed innocent, he shouldn't be deprived of his rights to walk the streets and work at his job and sleep in his home and do the other things that free people are entitled to do until such time as his guilt has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt and he has been convicted of this offense. But on the other hand, we can't just simply let people go and just simply say to a defendant, okay, you're charged with a crime, we're going to have your trial in 6 months, you come back at that time, because experience shows that many times defendants don't come back. Many times they skip bail. And so bail is imposed for the purpose of ensuring that the defendant will show up for his court appearances. Basically, the way it works is we say to the defendant, okay, you need to put up a bail of $1,000. If you make all of your court appearances, then at the end of the case, you get your $1,000 back. If you're found guilty and you owe a fine, we'll take the fine out of it. But other than that, you'll get your money back. So if you make your appearances, this doesn't cost anything. However, practical fact of the matter is the average defendant in a criminal case doesn't have the kind of money that it takes to make bail. And so what he usually has to do is go to a bail bondsman, and you'll find shops and offices around town that offer bail bond. Usually they set up their storefront shops pretty close to where the courthouse and the jailhouse are. But anyway, the bail bondsman will sign statements for the defendant saying, I will agree that I will be responsible for this defendant's $1,000 bail if this defendant does not make his court appearance. In other words, the defendant shows up, the bail bondsman has to forfeit the $1,000. Now, bail bondsmen, of course, aren't doing this just out of the goodness of their heart. They are doing it in return for a fee. And so let's say if the bail for this case, it's a relatively minor case, if the bail for this case is $1,000, then the bail bondsman will put up that $1,000 for the defendant, but the defendant has to give him a fee for doing so. Usually that fee will be about 10% of the total amount of the bail. Bail is $1,000, 10% would be $100. The defendant has to pay the bail bondsman $100. Now, that money is not refunded. If he is found guilty after the case is over with and he's made all his court appearances, found not guilty, made all his court appearances, or if, let's say, the day after he posts bail, it's found that this was completely a case of mistaken identity and the charges are dropped, the defendant is still out the $100 that he paid to the bail bondsman. And so this is an imposition, but it's one that many would say is necessary in order to ensure that defendants do appear, because many times they do not. There are also cases sometimes where the court might say that because this defendant has shown himself to be violent, or maybe the defendant has made threats to other people, the court might say that we don't believe that any amount of bail money can ensure the defendant's appearance or protect the public from this defendant, so we're going to deny bail in this case. And in rare cases, that will be done. In capital cases, very often there will be no bail at all. And we'll explain why that's the case as we return from our break in just a little bit. But what the court is trying to do in imposing bail, what the whole bail system is about, is to ensure that the public is protected, that the defendant is going to make his court appearances, but also to ensure that the defendant is not deprived of his liberty right until such time as he's convicted of the crime.
Again, we are back. This is Constitution Classroom. Your host is Colonel John Eidsmo from the Foundation for Moral Law. And Colonel, you are giving us a terrific explanation of excessive bail as it applies to the Eighth Amendment in the Bill of Rights.
Yes, and as we have seen, sometimes, in rare cases, the court will deny bail. And the court will deny bail either because this person is a threat to the public. We are not sure people would be safe. Maybe witnesses will be murdered or beaten up if he is released. Or maybe he has shown such a record in the past that he is going to leave the jurisdiction and not likely to show up for his court appearances, that we will decide that no amount of money that we put up would enable us to be sure that he would make his appearances. So both conditions, then, we simply say that bail must be denied. But those are rare. No. So the Eighth Amendment prohibits not bail, but excessive bail. So what do we mean by excessive bail? Well, the answer to that question is excessive bail is one penny more than is necessary to ensure the defendant's appearance. But how much is that? The court can't really climb into the mind of the defendant to find out. And so how do we do that? It'd be nice if the court could just simply say, okay, you're charged with armed robbery. Now, armed robbery carries a five-year sentence. If we were to set your bail at $10,000, would you show up for your hearings or would you skip out? Well, Your Honor, $10,000 versus 5 years in jail, $10,000, I think I'd skip out. Okay, well, what if we set bail at $20,000? Oh, $20,000, I'd show up. Okay, $20,000 it is. Well, obviously, the court can't do that. We can't come into the mind of the defendant. So in order to determine what is a proper amount of bail, there are several factors we look to. And the first is, what is the defendant charged with? The more severe the case, the greater the sentence could be, the more likely it is that a higher amount of money is going to be necessary to ensure the defendant's appearance. Let's say you have a person who's charged with driving while intoxicated, and let's say if the maximum fine there would be maybe $1,000 and or 30 days in jail, well, $5,000 bail might be sufficient to ensure that the defendant is going to show up rather than he would risk that short jail time and risk the fine rather than forfeit the $5,000 of bail. So it may be sufficient there, but if you have somebody who is charged with, let's say, first-degree murder, where maybe there's the death penalty or life imprisonment, we probably say, no, $5,000 isn't sufficient to ensure that somebody wouldn't skip out facing that. We might even say no amount would be sufficient for a capital murder case. But if it's a more severe case, let's say armed robbery or aggravated robbery or kidnapping, there we might say we need a higher amount of bail, like maybe $100,000 or maybe even more. So that's one factor we look at. What is the nature of the offense? The more severe the possible punishment, the greater the amount of money that will be necessary in bail to ensure the defendant's appearance. Second thing we will look at is the defendant's own record and his own ties to the community. The idea here is that if a defendant is tied to this community, he's less likely to skip out than he is a transient passing through. So if I'm trying to get the amount of bail to be low, what I'll probably do is I'll try to demonstrate to the judge, look, Your Honor, the defendant was born and raised here in this community. He's lived here all his life. He works at a steady job here. He's got a wife and children. He owns a house. He's registered to vote here. And with all his ties to the community, it's not likely that he's going to skip out. Now, let's say I have a client who's picked up passing through town. Well, that seems a little unfair to that person. And so what I'd probably argue to the court in that case, I mean, sometimes you just have to play the hand you're dealt with. What I would probably argue in that case is, Your Honor, it is not fair that we have one standard of bail for people who live here and a different standard for people from out of town. That simply is not fair, Your Honor. And some judges might agree with that argument. Or if I've got a defendant that has a perfect record, let's say that the defendant has never made a court appearance or never had to make a court appearance, this is his first offense, I'd say this is a model citizen, Your Honor. He has never had any infractions in the past, that we've got no reason to think that he's going to skip out here, and so I'd urge a low bail in that case. Let's say if I've got somebody with a lengthy record, again, you play the hand you're dealt with, and I might argue in that case, well, Your Honor, look at my client's record. 64 charges filed against him throughout his lifetime. 128 court appearances, and he made every one of them. There's a perfect record, Your Honor. In other words, you play the hand you're dealing with, and you make an argument based on the fact. But those are some of the circumstances that we look at in determining what bail ought to be. Now, if the bail is set at, let's say, $100,000, and the defendant doesn't have $100,000, which most defendants don't, we do have some cases, by the way, especially where we're dealing with drug dealers who are many times able to flash large amounts of money and carry large amounts of cash with them, where we might say that because of this person's lifestyle and because of his ready access to cash, he's not likely to think losing $100,000 bail is very severe, and so we need more to ensure his appearance in this case. But when we require $100,000 bail, that means the defendant has to pay the bondsman $10,000. That is not going to be refunded. What if he doesn't have $10,000? Well, we might give a mortgage to the deed of his house. We might sign over his car. He may have relatives, family, and so on that are willing to post the bail bond for him and so on. But anyway, nevertheless, when the case is over, he loses that $1,000, that $10,000, regardless of what happens, even if he's completely innocent. And that seems unfair. So a number of states have adopted a program that they call bail reform, and that's being abused some today in some jurisdictions where they're just releasing criminals. But bail reform in some states has taken the form that instead of requiring the defendant to pay 10% to a bail bondsman, he can simply put up 10% of the bond to the court itself, and he will be liable for the entire amount if he doesn't make his appearances. But if he does make his appearances, he'll receive his 10% back, maybe minus a small administrative fee. So bail reform has been tried in a number of jurisdictions, and I think the jury is still out on whether or not this is going to work effectively as far as if it means a lot more people are skipping out than would otherwise, then obviously we have to reconsider this. If it still is ensuring people appear, then maybe this is a good thing. And I might add, too, bail bondsmen commonly do more than just simply put up that bail. Obviously, if I'm a bail bondsman and I put up $100,000 bond for somebody, I don't want to lose that $100,000. And so if my client does not show up for a court appearance and the court calls me, the bail bondsman, and says, the guy you just bonded for he's not here for his appearance, well, I'll probably make some efforts to get him there. And commonly, bail bondsmen are people that have some pretty good ties to the criminal community and the area. And if they call that bail bondsman, that bondsman probably will have a fair idea what bar this guy might be sleeping in or who might know him. And the bondsman will come and shake the guy awake and in a rather rough way, give him some convincing reasons why he really ought to make this appearance. And so they do some positive work in making sure people do make their appearances. Anyway, we'll just see the result on bail reform.
Colonel, we have just about a minute left, and I don't know if you have time or inclination. I'd love to get your take on the Supreme Court rejecting Nevada's challenge to their state's shutdown restrictions over COVID concerns.
Well, yes, I do, and I'm disappointed that the court did not take up this case. However, need to understand what it is. This is a rule here that says no more than 50 people can come for a church, but no such limitations for casinos and other facilities and so on. And the churches have been appealing this. The court simply said in this case that what you're asking for here, an emergency order, an emergency injunction, this is an extraordinary remedy we give only in very rare circumstances. So they weren't inclined to do so in this case. This doesn't mean, however, that the Supreme Court agrees that Nevada can do this, just that this was not so clear cut as to justify an emergency order for an injunction. The final word is out on what the Supreme Court is going to do, and I'm certainly hoping ultimately they'll rule for the churches.